All right, we're ready for Deuteronomy chapters 11 and 12. And this is our outline that we're following. We are in the second major section, the second sermon. No matter how you divide the sermons, three or four sermons, we're in the second sermon. That distinction doesn't come to play till we get to about chapter 31. But anyway, this is where, as Wiersbe outlines it, Moses looks within, practical concerns. I want to tweak this outline here, this subpoint. These are from Wiersbe. He uses the terminology of Deuteronomy 6 and also of Deuteronomy 12 of the testimony, statutes, and judgments. And so 5 through 11, and we're going to finish through 11 and then start into 12. But he calls that the testimonies, then the statutes, and the judgments. And that's not a bad outline. But on the first of those, chapters 5 through 11, the focal point seems primarily to be obedient to the law. Does he talk about that principle again after 12? Sure, even in chapter 12. The statutes section, 12 to 18, focuses on the laws themselves. He had introduced the law back in chapter 5, but he focuses more on what some of the regulations and laws are. Chapters 19 and forward, he primarily focuses on the judgments, and such as the blessings and the cursings that we'll talk about even in our study tonight. Make sense? So when we get to chapter 12, we're going to shift gears a little bit. If this were, and it is a sermon, that if we were listening to Moses present this, it's like he's ready for another sub-point at chapter 12. He's shifting gears a little bit here at chapter 12, if that makes sense to you. All right, let's review our chapters of where we've been. Chapter 1. He reviewed from Sinai to Kadesh. Chapter 2, still reviewing. Yeah, and victory over Sihon. Chapter 3 obviously comes to Og. So Sihon and Og go together, close together in close proximity. So Moses there is also forbidden. Now this chapter 4 winds up the first sermon, and what was it about? Obedience, the necessity thereof, of that obedience. Very good. All right, now we begin the second sermon, chapter 5. What was it about? What was chapter 5 about? Ten commandments. Very good. And the people fear God. Chapter 6 kind of backs up and looks at the law itself. Place the warning in the meaning of the law. Kind of a broader view of the law. Specifics of the law, chapter 5, is a broader view of the law, chapter 6. All right, chapter 7. All right, yeah. You are a separate, distinct people, remain pure. Chapter 8. All right, yes, keeping the commandments of God. So here we're getting into this, chapters 5 through 11, focusing primarily on keeping the law, obedience to the law. He's going to shift gears at chapter 12. All right, chapter 9. Yeah, warning against pride and self-righteousness. Don't think if you go into the land or when you get there, it was by your own righteousness at all. And then chapter 10, yeah, mercy and obedience. So notice again this principle of obedience. Chapter 11 flows right into that. So what's chapter 11 about? Question number one. All right, love and obeying the Lord is what we call chapter 11. Now you may want to give a different title to that. These titles that we're giving here are either something I've borrowed or I have coined for myself, what I think summarizes the chapter. And so I call it simply love and obey the Lord. Love the Lord and obey the Lord. Love goes hand in hand. One of the first things I learned from verse 1 is what it means to love the Lord. Therefore you shall love the Lord your God. It doesn't end there, but keep his charge. And we'll get to that charge here in just a second. Here's what we're going to see in chapter 11. The instruction to love and obey the Lord, the reasons to love and obey the Lord, and a blessing and a curse for whether you do or do not obey the Lord. Make sense? Good way to wind up this first subsection of the sermon, chapters 5 through 11. It seems like he has three divisions here, 5 through 11, and then 12 to 18 and 19 to 26. All right, let's talk about this instruction here at verse 1. His instruction is, you shall love the Lord your God and keep his charge. There's two things, but they go hand in hand. that if they don't keep the charge, whatever that is, then they don't love the Lord. Let's talk about this word charge here. We haven't seen this one much. I think this is the first time we've seen that in Deuteronomy, and that's this word charge. It simply means responsibility or obligation. This is not the first time we've seen the term, but I think it's the first time we've seen it in Deuteronomy. It means, or it's translated ordinance in Leviticus. In Nehemiah, it's translated duties. Zechariah, it's translated command. So keep the charge of the Lord. So love the Lord and keep His charge, keep His command, keep His ordinance, keep His duties. This is your responsibility and your obligation. It's a weight that you carry. And so I think the next phrases, three phrases that he uses, his statutes and his judgments and his commands, are a amplification of the charge. So I would chart it like this, that love the Lord and keep His charge, which includes keeping His statutes and His judgments and His commands. That makes sense? They overlap a great deal. And we've talked about this in chapter 6. I think the statute focuses on the regulations of the law. There are certain regulations of the law, but there's not much difference in a statute and a command. A command is something they were told to do. The judgments would have to do with the verdict. So God would say, for example, you are to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. Well, then that's a command of God, but a statute may have to do with certain requirements of a sacrifice. And for example, not the eating of blood, that would be a statute. A judgment would be some of the verdicts that if you do this, you're going to not live long in the land, or I'll drive you out of the land, or I'll not let rain come upon the land. We'll see that even in chapter 11 and 12. Does that make sense? Now, that's verse 1. That's the charge, the responsibility. Now, what reasons are given for doing that? Starting with verse 2. Go ahead. All right, they've been delivered from Egypt. There's really two things here. One is what they've seen in the past, and they will be blessed in the future. Isn't that the reason we should obey the Lord? Look at what He's done for you in the past, and that ought to drive you, no matter what the future you think may hold, just look at what God's done for you in the past. That ought to give you reason enough to be obedient to the Lord. But there's another reason to obey the Lord. Look at how you will be blessed if you do obey the Lord. Does that make sense? All right, let's look at the past. Now, the point of the past here is not merely to go into great detail, but reminding them of things. So we're not going to expand in great detail on that. Time would forbid it. But I don't want us to lose the train of thought starting here at verse 2. So let's look at verses 2 to 4. What had been done in Egypt? All right. The plagues, he alludes to the plagues and the deliverance through the sea, right? So let's start at verse 2. That know today that I speak that I do not speak to your children who have not known and who have not seen the chastening of the Lord your God. Now the term chastening can include any form of discipline. It can have reference to punishment. It can have reference to instruction. In the New Testament times, Hebrews 12, the chastening of the Lord included persecution that God used to mold and shape His children. So it's a broad term. I think here, as Colin Daylitt suggests, that it probably does not refer to punishment, but to instruction. That you got a chastening, an instruction, an education from the Lord when you saw what happened in Egypt. And what'd they see? Well, they saw His greatness, His mighty hand, His outstretched arm, the signs and acts which He did in the midst of Egypt. That would have reference, somebody just mentioned a moment ago, the plagues. Yeah, the plagues, the signs and the acts which He did in the midst of Egypt to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all in his land. And then verse 4, what He did to the army of Egypt and the horses, He's talking about what? When they went into the sea and they were drowned in the sea and they overflowed. And as they pursued, and as the Lord has destroyed them to this day. Now take note of the fact that they saw the power of God, and they also saw wicked people, the Egyptians, punished. That's two mighty things to learn. Does that make sense? We're going to flag those in a moment. I'm flagging them now, but we'll pick them up a little bit later when we get to the end of this. All right, let's go to verse 5. Talks about something else. He just gives one sweeping statement, but it encompasses most of Numbers. What does verse 5 say? What he did for you in the wilderness up until this place. So that takes them from the crossing of the Red Sea till now. I mean now as in the time that Moses is speaking. Well, there's a lot happened. Can you think of some? Say again. They were fed with manna. They were fed with quail till they got sick of it. Where'd they get the water? God gave it to them from a rock. What about their clothes? Didn't wear out. Their sandals didn't wear out. The feet didn't swell. God took care of them. That's the point. So remember, look at your past, what God did in Egypt. Look what God did in the wilderness for you. He didn't have to remind them. They know what they had taken place. At least they should remember. Then verse 6. Here's another important thing to remember. Remember what happened to Dathan and Abiram? Why is Korah not mentioned? I don't know. Some suggest that he wasn't the ringleader that Dathan and Abiram were. I don't know. But that doesn't excite me that he wasn't mentioned here. But all he's doing is reminding them of the rebels in the wilderness. What happened to those rebels? Earth swallowed them up. Where are we going to find that story? Number 16. All right. So that was the earth opened up its mouth and swallowed them. So again, they see the story. Here's a second instance of God punishing the wicked. Should they be learning something? This is a sermon, by the way. He's preaching for them to learn something and to put it into application. And so God punished the rebels in the wilderness, verse 6. Now verse 7 kind of broadens and gives a bigger picture. What does he say at verse 7? Your eyes have seen every great act of the Lord which he did. There are other things not enumerated here. All he's doing is, let's look at the past. So why should you be obedient? Why should you keep the charges, statutes, judgments, and so on? Why should you do that? By looking at the past, at what God has done. Does that make sense? All right, let's go further. Now, I said we'd flag some things. Looking at the past, they should have seen three things. They saw the power of God, it brought them out of Egypt. They saw the wicked were punished, that is the Egyptians, the rebels in the wilderness, and God's providential care. If that's not enough to drive someone to obedience, then just forget it, because nothing's going to work. Does that make sense? Can we look at our past and see anything that God has done that makes us say, I want to be obedient, I want to submit to his will, because look what's been done in the past. He forgave me of my sins. You helped me with my list. Sent his son to die. Think there's some providential care? Think there's some blessings in there somewhere since the time you were born? Maybe a godly family, or maybe you became what you are in spite of an ungodly family. Maybe someone loved you and cared for you and taught you the truth. Well, I see a lot of things in the past that ought to drive us toward obedience. Does that make sense? All right, let's move on. Now, the next thing that he mentions as a reason is how they will be blessed. So he looks now to the future. Now, let's get verses 8 and 9. What's he saying in verses 8 and 9? All right. There's a couple of words we need to flag here at verses 8 and 9. One is, I notice a number of times the word every or all. Obey. God doesn't just say obey the commands, obey the ordinances, but obey every command, obey all, etc. That's one. In Deuteronomy 6, there was a key word, you obey. And then there's an important word, Well, careful. That's one word we're going to see about three or four times tonight. That's very good. The word that, remember that in Deuteronomy 6? That you do this, that you should do thus and so. All right, let's do that at verse 8. Verse 8, therefore you should keep every commandment of God which I command you today, that you may be strong. You want to be strong? That you may be strong and go in and possess the land. And that you may prolong your days in the land. I don't think that's talking about longevity of life, but their longevity in the land. Does that make sense? You keep obeying, you're going to go in the land and you're going to stay in the land. You and your people. Now this generation may die and the next generation come along, but you're going to stay in the land. You want to keep this land and keep perpetually in this land, you're going to have to be obedient. Does that make sense? That you may be strong and that you may possess the land and keep possessing the land. So why should you obey? Because you want to be blessed. Make sense? All right. Let's pick up at verse 10 because if you have a previous outline, I put verse 10 and 10 and 11 and 12, I think, with the first point. But I think 10 through 17 go together better. I think that tightens the outline a little bit. So let's see what he's talking about. If you obey the Lord, you're going to have rain and you're going to be blessed with crops. So if you want it to go well with you in the land, then you have to be obedient. So look at verse 10. For the land which you're going in to possess is not like Egypt. How is it not like Egypt? All right, it's how it's watered. That you sowed your seed and you watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. Well, there's two or three things some have suggested. Maybe the carrying of water, probably not the case. Some have suggested that as they would divert water trying to irrigate, that they would move the dirt by their foot. More likely, most commentators suggest that that referred to an irrigating system where there was a pumping wheel that was powered by the foot. In other words, they had to get their water to their crops. So they had to pump the water either by foot or somehow divert it by foot. Anyway, they had to work to get water to their crops in the land of Egypt. But, verse 11, you're going to cross over to this land, and how's the water going to come to their crops? God's going to give them water, but there's something about the lay of the land. There's hills and valleys and which drinks water from heaven. So here's the water that runs down the hills and fills and flows into the valley so that they have fertile valleys. Does that make sense? So you're not going to be pumping the wheel. You're not going to be diverting the water with your foot. You're not going to be carrying the water with your feet. You're going to be blessed. So if you want your crops to multiply, then you need to be obedient. Now let's go further. Verse 12, the land which the Lord God cares, the eyes of the Lord are always on it from the beginning of the year to the end. Now, you're going to see the significance of the beginning to the end. Now, here's a key word, verse 13. What's the key word here? If you diligently obey, I'm reading the New King James, you may have a different word there. If you diligently obey, we're going to make a play on that word in a moment, and you love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, what's going to happen at verse 14? You're going to get rain. This is something we're going to see all through the Bible. The early and the latter rain. Now, in Palestine, that was essential for a crop. The early rain, this may sound quite the opposite of what you're thinking, but the early rain was thought to be the rain from October to December. The late rain would come between March and April. Both were essential for them to have a fertile crop. Does that make sense? It's kind of like when you plant in our society, you plant your crop and you've got to have rain to get it going. But before it yields toward the end, if it hasn't rained in a while, you're not going to have a fertile crop. So you've got to have rain then. You've got to have the early and the latter rain. God said, I'll give it to both of you. I'll give both of those to you if you're obedient. So you don't have to worry about the rain. I'm going to bless you abundantly with your crops. Now that gets us through verse 17. Now verse 18. What do you learn from verse 18? You take these words of mine, what are you going to do with them? You're going to lay them up in your heart. Deuteronomy 6:6. Why do I mention Deuteronomy 6:6? Because, same thing. This is almost a direct quotation from Deuteronomy 6. Not a big surprise. Same preacher, another sermon, he repeats some same points. You ever heard that? Well, sure. If he's got a good point here, it may need to be emphasized over here. You say, I've heard that before. Yeah, and you may hear it again. And that seems to be what Moses is doing. Here's a good point that he had made back there. So he says, you're going to take the words and commit them to your heart. Lay them in your heart. And put them as a sign on your hand and as frontlets between the eyes. The Jews interpreted that literally, and thus they had their phylacteries that they put on their head. And then they tied their phylacteries on their they had it on their head and on their hands. And come up on their elbows, up on their arms. So they carried the scriptures with them. That's not the idea. The point is, you commit it to your heart and you implement them in your lives. And then you're going to do what? Verse 19. Teach them diligently to your children. You write them on the doorpost. That, verse 21, that what? That your days be multiplied. Again, not talking about longevity of their life. Days multiplied in what sense? When you go into the land, you're going to keep staying in the land. Does that make sense? I think that's the idea of their multiplying. There's nothing here that promised longevity of life. You obey God and you're going to live a long life. And I don't know of any promise of that. You obey the Lord, for them, they're going to stay in the land and not going to be driven out of the land. When they were driven out of the land, it was because of their wickedness. All right, let's pick up it now at verse 22. Here's a key word. Philip just mentioned it a moment ago. It's the word carefully. All right, starting at verse 22, the Lord's going to drive the people out. This is part of the blessing if you carefully keep all the commandments and walk in all his ways and hold fast to him. He'll drive out the nations. Now notice, these are nations that are, verse 23, greater and mightier. Don't worry about the giants. Don't worry about the giants. What else do you see down through verse 25 before we shift gears? Yeah, they're going to take a lot of territory. Verse 24, that every place where your foot will tread, in other words, God's going to take them. We'll get to this when we get to Joshua. They're going to come through the middle. They're going to take a campaign to the north and to the south. And so they're going to take a large swipe of territory. But then look at verse 25. No one will be able to stand against you, and God will put the dread. You're afraid of them, but I'll make them afraid of you because I'm with you. So notice what he's just said now. Here's the reasons to keep the charge. Look what God's done in the past, but look at the blessing of the future. If you want to be strong, possess the land, you want blessed with crops, you want your days to be multiplied, and you want the people driven out, then all you got to do is just obey me and everything's going to happen. Two strong reasons to obey. All right, now beginning at verse 26, he talks about a blessing and a curse. And verse 25, 26, and 27, 28, those four verses, or 26, 27, 28, three verses, just simply say what? Exactly, bingo. Yeah, if you obey, you're blessed. If you don't, you'll be cursed. And notice at verse 28, he warns about going after other gods. Now, verse 29 to 30 introduces a thought that we haven't seen so far. And look at verse 29. It shall be when the Lord God has brought you into the land to possess that you shall put a blessing on Mount Gerizim and a curse on Mount Ebal. And are they not on the other side of Jordan toward the setting of the sun by the trees of Morah, at the end of verse 30? For when you cross over Jordan, go in to possess the land, verse 31, you shall possess and dwell in it. And let's go ahead and get verse 32, and then I'm going to come back to the two mountains. What does he say at verse 32? Here's our word again. Philip mentioned it a moment ago. Careful. careful to observe. Might underline careful every time you see it. So be careful to observe. So his point here is that there is a, I'm going to put before you a blessing and a curse. If you obey, you'll be well blessed. If you don't obey, you're going to be greatly cursed. So thus, verse 32, you need to obey. What a conclusion to this subsection, because he's about ready to shift gears. Now, let's talk about the two mountains. You might get ready to put a footnote here, if you don't have footnotes in your Bible, to flag a couple of passages that'll help us to tie some passages together. The reading of the law from Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim is not done here. What he's saying is, when you get into the land, they're not there yet. They're not over there yet. They're still on the west side of Jordan. But when you get, on the east side of Jordan, when you get over there on the west side of Jordan and you've conquered the land, then I'm going to have the law read from Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. When is that done? Well, more information is given in Deuteronomy 27 through 29. So we're going to see more details of the law. So we're going to hold the comments about those till we get there. So you might flag Deuteronomy chapters 27 to 29 right here at verse 29. This is actually done in Joshua 8. So those are the passages you want to flag right here. Joshua 8, where it's done. It's not done now. It's not done while Deuteronomy's going on because they're not over there. So when we get to chapter 27, he's still talking about what's going to be done because 27 is being spoken on this side of Jordan, hadn't crossed yet. So Deuteronomy 27, 28, and 29, Joshua 8. Got it? All right. Here's where they are. Here's where Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. Now, I show you this little graph to show you the mountainous region there. And that these were two mountains that came close together. This was a picture from 1997, I think. And the purpose of this is from Logos Bible Software, to show the close proximity of the mountain. So it's not a mountain way off over here and a mountain way off over there. So you could have people standing on this mountain and people standing on this mountain, and because of the narrowness of the valley, they could hear one another. So the law over here is going to be read. That is the blessings, and over here the curses. We'll get to that in Joshua 8. But that's what he's talking about. And we'll look at similar pictures then when we get to Joshua 8. Make sense? It's going to be a blessing and a curse. Now let's see what we learned from chapter 11 before we go to 12. We'll try to wind 12 up here in a second. But I learned some things about how to love and how to obey, because that's where he started at verse 1, wasn't it? How to love the Lord and how to obey the Lord. Verse 1, you do this always. Key concept. Secondly, you obey every command. Every command. Thirdly, you serve God diligently with all of your heart. No half-hearted service. God's not interested in that. All right, here's the fourth thing. You take heed to, what does that mean? It means you look at yourself, you make application to yourself. Take heed to yourself. How does this fit me? All right. Number 5, carefully. We see that at verse 22, if you didn't flag it, verse 32, and 12 and 32. So we've seen it twice already. We'll see it again in chapter 12 and verse 32. In fact, we're going to see it in 12 and 1. I don't have all of them up there. I think there's 4 times in our study tonight. And then the last thing is, you do that in view of blessings and cursings. You love the Lord in view of, if I do this, I'll be blessed. If I don't, I will be cursed. Make sense? All right, let's see if we can get through chapter 12. Chapter 12, he shifts gears. And he's shifting points. And he's been talking about obedience, and now he's talking about more specifics of the requirements and statutes of the law. Does that make sense? Let's see what he says. He's going to start off by talking about destroying the places of idol worship. The heart of the chapter, though, deals with a central place of worship, which is not identified, by the way. That's interesting. We'll talk about that when we get there. And then don't try to be like the idolaters. We need to try to get through all 3 sections to make sense of this part of his sermon. So after you have flagged the word careful at verse 1, His point is, in verses 1 to 4, they need to do what? This is not the first time we've seen this. Get into the land, you're going to completely and utterly destroy idolatry. So, you're going to be careful to observe. You shall look at verse 2, to utterly destroy the places where the nations which you dispossess serve their gods on the high mountains. It was thought, very common thought among the pagans, that the higher you would get physically, the closer you get to your God. I can't imagine serving a God that your prayer means more because you're on a higher mountain and I'm down in the valley. That my God can hear down in the valley, can't yours? But they thought perhaps if you got on a higher place, and one of the warnings is going to be don't fall for that kind of stuff among them. You go and destroy their high places on every green hill, every sacred pillar, cut down their carved images and their gods, and destroy their names from the place. That's interesting. What does that tell you? Get it out of your mind, complete and utter destruction. None of this, well, I've cut way back in my sin, or we've trimmed the idolatry way back. No. You utterly destroy it. You take the name of their gods off of that. And you shall not worship the Lord your God with such a thing. In other words, don't use anything that's a part of idolatry in the worship and the service unto God. It's unacceptable. Now, let's begin at verse 5. So, the Lord's not going to be worshipped with that, utterly destroy the idols. Now, let's talk about the central place for worship. Now, this is in contrast to these idols. You're going to go in. This is what prompts this. It's not just, oh, by the way, let me talk about a place of worship. It's hit my mind. Now, that's not what Moses is doing. You're going to go in and destroy their places of worship. There's going to be one here. There's going to be one over there. There's going to be one on this high mountain. There's going to be one over here. There's going to be another place over there. In contrast to those places, the Lord will choose a place for you when you get into the land. Look at verse 5. This is a key verse. But you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses, not where you choose, but where the Lord chooses out of all your tribes. The Lord's going to choose a place. Now, where is that place? He doesn't identify that. We'll talk about that in a moment. We'll flag a couple of places. Now then, let's quickly work through the rest of this, because what we just saw there, and we're going to see again at verse 11. In fact, let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 11. Then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. So the Lord's going to choose the place. Does that make sense? Now, here's what we know about that. What does he tell us in 6 to 14? 6 and 7, first of all. When God chooses this place, once you get in the land, you're going to take your offerings and your sacrifice to that place. You're not going to offer just anywhere. That's verse 6 and 7. Now verse 8. You no longer are going to do whatever's right in your own eyes. You might underline that. Where do we see that phrase? We haven't seen it yet, but we're going to see it again. Judges 21. That's a summary of the period of the judges. Every man did that which is right in his own eyes. Judges 21, 25. And they're doing it here. So here's something I learned from verse 8. That seems to imply that during the wilderness wanderings, they had not gone to the tabernacle like they were supposed to go to the tabernacle, as they should. And that's exactly what they did even later. So notice he said, you shall not at all do as you are doing here today. Tells me they hadn't been doing what they should. Every man doing what's right in his own eyes. All right, 9 through 12, worship will be confined to the place that is chosen. So again, I see that at verse 11. And in interest of time, but look at verse 11. You should bring your the burnt offering and the sacrifices and the tithes, etc. Now I want to pick up at verse 13 and 14. You're not going to offer sacrifice just anywhere. Look at this at verse 14. Verse 13. You're not going to offer your sacrifice in every place that you see. In other words, you get ready to make a sacrifice. You're not going to make this one over here and that fellow makes his sacrifice over there. But in the place which, here's the third time he said it, which the Lord chooses, you shall offer the burnt offerings which I command you. So all we've learned so far, we didn't miss a lot there. I don't mean to say there was something that we missed that's it's unimportant. But we got the gist of 6 to 14 that all of Israel is going to come to this place that God chooses, and the place that God chooses is where you're going to worship. Now, he doesn't identify. That's going to be identified a little bit later. So let's get ahead of ourselves. Shiloh is the place that by the time we get to Joshua 18, Shiloh is the place where the tabernacle was established in a more permanent, the tabernacle never was permanent, but a more permanent setting. Does that make sense? Where they'd been moving it about, they set it up in Shiloh by Joshua 18. But ultimately, this is pointing to Jerusalem, when that's the place where what's going to be built? The temple is going to be built. So you ask me, what does Deuteronomy 12 talk about? It's talking about a central place God will choose. He chose Shiloh, and then when the temple was built, that's Jerusalem. So which is it talking about? I think it's talking about both. God will choose the place. He chose Shiloh, he chose Jerusalem. And if we find another place where they set up worship, then God had chose that. I mean, if it was approved by God, then God chose that. All right, let's go back to this regulation, because there may have been a change here, depending on your interpretation of Leviticus 17. So let's see what we've got here. Beginning at verse 15, that you may slaughter meat within all your gates, whatever your heart desires according to the blessing, and the clean and unclean may eat of it. That is, you're not going to eat of clean and unclean animals, but those who are clean and those who are unclean can eat of this meat. That's the point. Because even when those were unclean for a period of a week, they still had to eat. And that's the point. Now, Leviticus 17 has been interpreted a couple of ways. We said when we came to Leviticus 17, 8 and 9, I'll let you go back and look at that, that probably was talking about sacrifices only. It was not talking about their daily food. Some think it's talking about their daily food had to be slaughtered at the tabernacle. I don't think so. But if it is, then this is a change in that law here once they get into the land. If it's not a change, then, and I think it probably wasn't a change, that I'm thinking Leviticus 17, 8 and 9 is saying the same thing here. Does that make sense, or did I lose you? I think they're saying the same thing. But several think that it's not talking about the same thing and that this is an adaptation, a change in the law. I'll let you decide. So the point here is, in verses 15 and 16, that animals killed for table food would be allowed to be killed away from the central place. Does that make sense? Whether that was Leviticus 17 or not, that can be done in the future. And they could eat their tithe, but they would eat their tithe. In other words, an animal that would be killed and eaten as part of a tithe, that would be eaten at the central place, wherever that central place was, Shiloh or Jerusalem. Meat could be eaten if the place was too far. As they're camped around the tabernacle, it wouldn't be too far to go to the central place. But once they get into the land and are scattered, it's going to be too far. So there's an adaptation of the law once they get into the land. And then I want us to get verses 26 to 28 and talk about a couple of things there, and then we're going to move to the last section. Well, before we get to verse 28, let's go to verse 23. Get ready to flag a verse here that'll help, a chapter that'll help you. What do you learn from verse 23? And all the sacrifices you couldn't do what? Eat the blood. Where did I see this before? Leviticus 17. You might flag Leviticus 17. Why could they not eat blood? Life's in the blood. Acts 15, you say, well, that's Old Testament law. That's true. Acts 15 includes that as part of New Testament law, the eating of blood. And the same principle is true. Life is in the blood. That explains a lot of things, by the way, life being in the blood. Why God demanded blood sacrifice, etc. Now notice it, verse 25, before we go to verse 26. Here's a phrase that we saw in Deuteronomy 6. If you obey the Lord, it will do what? It will go well with you. You want life to go well? then you're going to have to be obedient. Now, what's 26 to 28 tell us? that you take the burnt offering, that would be taken to the central place, which is the place that God chooses, Shiloh or Jerusalem, depending on the time frame. But I want to look at verse 28. Observe and do what? Obey what? All those words which I command you. And then what's going to happen? It'll go well with you. Deuteronomy 6. All right. Now let's get this last section right here. 29 to 32. I think we got time to do that. So don't try to be like the idolaters. Now some words are used here that we haven't seen so far. I don't know if that means much to you, but it does to me. If we come across something that's a repeat of a previous chapter, I like to flag that. And if it's a new thought we hadn't seen, I like to flag that. This is new stuff. So in verse 29 and 30, don't inquire how they worship. Now that's interesting to me. Then when you go in and displace the people, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them. You could easily be ensnared, trapped into following them. And do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? And I will do likewise. So what's that about? I don't know that it's saying, you know, when you go into a land and they have this idol, that you are forbidden to know how they worship that god. I don't know of anything that would forbid that. Maybe that's what that was about. But the idea is, Pulpit suggests it was a common thought that if you went into a country and you ignored that country's gods, that there would be calamity come upon you. And so what is your god? Well, this is our god here, and we bow down before him and praise him, so I better do that too, lest a calamity come upon me. Don't go into a nation and inquire of their gods. Ignore their gods. They're worthless gods. And don't try to adapt to that. Does that make sense? Now then, verse 31 and 32. Our time's about gone. What does he say at verse 31? Yeah, don't do that because God hates what is done to their gods. They even go so far. Yeah, that's the idol Molech. They worship the idol Molech, where they burn their children to the fire. Well, before we get through, guess what? By the time of Jeremiah, children of Israel are doing that. And then finally, verse 31, here's thy word again for the fourth time. I think it's the fourth. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe, and don't add to or take away from it. Don't alter it in any way. We saw that in chapter 4, by the way, in verse 2. At the end of the first sermon, don't add to and don't take away. Make sense? All right. We have asked each time, watch for the term fear. Fear is not found in these two chapters, so we didn't learn anything about the fear of God. The term careful closely relates to that, but the term fear is not used here. We'll find it again in some of our other chapters. We're going to have to stop right there.